Welcome to the dialogue series, Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership for the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Mark Forman. Mark is a licensed psychotherapist and the clinical director of Life Design Center, an innovative psychotherapy studio dedicated to changing the lives of individuals, couples, children, and families. He's also the executive director of Meta Integral Psychotherapy Center and the lead organizer of the Integral Theory Conference. And I've known Mark for a few years now, and we've always shared a strong mutual interest in gender issues, and I find Mark a really unique and complex thinker, and we've wanted to do a dialogue on men's issues and its intersection with feminism and women's issues for some time, so I'm excited about this particular dialogue. So Mark, it's a real pleasure to have you here, so welcome.
Thank you, Vanessa. It's my pleasure.
So maybe I'm curious to start just to hear a bit about your personal story and how you kind of got interested in men's issues. And you're obviously a man, so that would be part of it. But I'm curious if having a son and working with male clients in your own psychotherapeutic practice sort of made you especially sensitive to the current challenges and opportunities facing men.
Sure. So I think the easiest place to start would be that I came from a split family. So my parents divorced when I was about 3 years old, and my father, we were living in the northeast of the U.S. at the time, my father left to go to Israel, and I have not seen him since, so I'm 37, so that would have been 33 or so years ago. And some of what I know about that is that he essentially became psychotic during my first couple of years and drifted off and developed something of a real messiah complex. So he was a complex character, but I think, you know, the family story is that I was quite close to him. And so, you know, that obviously left quite a mark on me. And I think started me on a path, you know, not having a father figure around. So I was left a little bit with a question around masculinity and not having a guide. And then also kind of a personal question of where I fit in. And probably the other relevant piece of that is that, you know, all of the other male figures in my life, both my grandfathers would die within the next 3 or 4 years. My uncles scattered and as a group did not do a really good job of filling any of the gaps. So I was really, as a kid, my feeling around maleness was mostly self-determined in the sense that, you know, what I was able to come up with, and I don't mean that this as a conscious process, but I mean whatever I was able to generate around a sense of male identity was kind of my own. What I had to fill the gap, though, was that I was a good athlete, and I played a lot of sports, and so I was surrounded by a lot of boys and men. And so I kind of carried with me, I would say, a certain kind of wounding around not having a male figure, and always was searching for what that would mean to me to be a man, although I wouldn't have had the words when I was young. And so by the time I got to be a teenager, I sort of kept immersing myself in male context, partially because I was, in a certain way, encouraged by my mother, and partially because I was really interested. So I ended up studying martial arts for 10 years. I played football, and I sort of hung around in those contexts. And I think, in retrospect, that was very healing, and there were mentors involved. And then later on, I would enter psychotherapy and was particularly drawn to having male therapists. And so those ended up, several of them ended up being mentors for me. Now, at the same time, I should say my mother was a very powerful figure. You know, she was a psychiatrist. She was Yale trained. At her time of going through Yale, she was one of four women in Yale's entire class. Wow. And she was the chief of her department and is an extremely bright person, extremely capable. And so I didn't have, you know, I hear, you know, in the ether about biases that people have that women can't do this or that women are less capable than men, and that just was not my reality in any sense. I really took it in like water. And so that's an important thing for me because I've always felt comfortable with female leadership and I don't really make the distinction in a certain way between male and female. I make a lot more distinctions between what I think is quality leadership and not quality leadership. So I would say that's a little bit of background to say that, you know, this has been something of a lifelong question for me. And then in my own professional work, I've been sitting clinical for probably 11 years now. I've just seen a lot of boys and a lot of men, largely because that is who comes and gets sent to me. Profession now, some psychotherapies, in the olden days it was more men. Now I think the average graduate class is probably more like 70% female. And so there's a dearth of male clinicians. And so there's a lot of interest in having a male clinician, particularly for male clients. So I would say my client load is probably 75% men, and it's been that way. So I've sat, you know, therapy with just hundreds of men. I just have a lot of experience sitting with other men.
Do you want to share some of the challenges you're seeing men facing, or just some of the big sort of developmental areas that men are working on, or just, yeah, what you're seeing generally in your practice in life?
Sure. So this was a question that you and I had bounced around a little bit before the dialogue, and it's such a complex question to which I hear many answers that I think are very partial. So I actually sat down and wrote out a bit of a list. So I think the first one that comes to mind is I think that the culture has lost a sense of healthy male ethnocentrism. So, you know, we all go through a stage of thinking ethnocentrically, and that applies as well to gender. We just think of in-group and out-group. And I think what has happened in part in the culture is that we've lost a healthy male ethnocentrism. So I think we've lost a healthy sense of conformity and kind of traditional thinking about what is really good about being a male. Usually when we see men in the news, you know, and this is my perception of it, that we usually see men in the news when they've done something wrong, and then they're men. It's a very interesting distinction in the way we label them. And then when they do something right, we celebrate them, but we usually do not celebrate their maleness. So for boys and men growing up, they don't get a message anymore about what is good about being men. They're really only told, I think, what they shouldn't do, all of the mistakes and bad things men and boys are not supposed to do. And probably that's not 100% true, but I think that's the predominant cultural moment. And yet, we at the same time have a pretty intense celebration of women as women. So when women achieve and contribute, they are both achievers and contributors and women and girls. So girl power. That, think of that as a concept. Do we have boy power anymore? No, we don't. And so I think that that is a huge piece, because just as a general rule, when you are going to identify, we all identify with our sex. It's probably the most robust identification. There's a lot of complexity when you're talking about transgendered issues and stuff, but more or less our identification as male and female develops very early, 2, 3, or 4, and never changes, and it's a central identification. If you're going to call somebody or think of somebody something, and you think of somebody as something, and you only point out the negatives of that and not the positives, that's when you create psychopathology. That's when you create problems in identity. If I were to wrap up this challenge, I would say that there's just a lack of appreciation for masculinity.
So, like, there's kind of an identity crisis for men in regards to identifying with maleness or understanding what that means.
I think there's an identity crisis in the sense that some of the roles are changing quickly, and, you know, men, like women, I think are very confused. I mean, we've undergone a more radical change in our social roles, and this is certainly a challenge in the last 50 years than probably in any previous period of human history. But it's not quite saying there's an identity challenge. But I would say that's more of a cultural and socialization crisis. that we are doing a very bad job of raising young boys in a healthy way because we've too quickly abandoned some of the ways in which boys and men have been socialized in the past. And if I were to say it this way, the problem or question of how you socialize your men is one of the central questions of all society. It's a major problem as far back as written kind of philosophical work. The Romans, the Greeks understood this. You know, what is the ideal life? How should men be raised and brought into society in a certain kind of way? So it's been a self-conscious problem, at least in Western culture. And I think they came up with some answers to that. And I think part of another challenge that men have is we've lost touch with a lot of those traditional frames. And we've lost touch, particularly, I think, as men are growing up. Challenging those traditional frames is useful, but it's a complex project that's more suited to adults who've been somewhere. And so what I see is a lot of young men who have no traditional framework or structure, who have not done anything with their lives, and have not identified in a certain kind of healthy, traditional, conformist way with any kind of masculinity, and then they're sort of dropped into a postmodern soup that is over their head. And then they have to almost go backwards and find these questions of who they are as men because they were never taught. Then they've internalized a lot of negativity about who they are as men, but not a lot of positivity. And so their strengths have not been identified, and they struggle. And so this for me is one of the reasons why I think we see some male underperformance in these current generations. Because, you know, men are, we talk a lot about being men as self-guided, but we don't talk nearly as much about men needing socialization and mentorship, et cetera. Being a man, I think, is something, to the extent that we can nail that down, is something you become. It's not something you just are gifted into because you have a male body.
And I'm just curious if you see the role of ritual in there at all. You know, like, you know, in the past we've had like age-appropriate rituals to kind of bring men and women into different phases of their life. Do you see that at all as part tied into what you're saying?
I think ritual is very important, and, you know, a lot of writers have written about our lack of initiation rites as a culture, and I take that seriously, except that the initiation rite or ritual is only meaningful to the extent that it introduces you or births you into an actual role as a male.
Yeah.
So if you don't have the role defined that the ritual becomes the gateway to, then you can't have a ritual. So what would we ritualize our boys into today? And I'm afraid that we would ritualize them into knowing everything they shouldn't do as men, and we would ritualize them into very few things that we would be comfortable saying, this is what you ought to be as a man. Give them positive initiation and vision, and also give them a sense that their masculinity and maleness is actually important to the world. And this is one of these huge ironies of the current moment. You know, we have a book talking about the end of men, as if men were some disposable aspect of the culture. And this kind of title and book gets major play in the culture. And it's both asinine as a statement, it's insulting as a statement, but it's also incredibly inaccurate and short-sighted. And that's probably one of the more extreme data points, but I think only in our current moment could we say something like that. And then you have to imagine you're just a little boy and you grow up getting these messages and you see it in the culture and you see it on television, that usually the dupe, usually the stupid one in a commercial, in a television show, in a sitcom, is the father. You see these things, and what are you going to feel? And I don't want to say that this is just being imposed on men. Men are participating in this by making mistakes and by not speaking up in a certain kind of way. So it's a whole group problem. So just to close the question, I would say we can do rituals, but we need to decide something about meaning and roles before we do that.
Right. So we'll come back to the End of Men article because I want to talk more about that and contextualize that a little bit more, and also from kind of as someone who's been studying women's issues, and I have some thoughts on it too. But let's go back to the questions around masculinity. You know, you said a couple things. One, at the beginning, you said you kind of don't make a strong distinction between maleness and femaleness in this. You look in leaders, you're looking more for just what's good leadership. So maybe the masculine-feminine divide seemed not as strong. But then you've also been talking about the importance of these kind of traditional structures. So I'm curious how you just kind of see masculinity, you know, and it's important for men at this point in our collective history. You know, some of the men's movements that have emerged over the last 50 years and still existing today have focused on this notion of a reclaiming of the masculine for men's wholeness. And I'm just curious what you think of this kind of approach and this notion of reclaiming masculinity and, you know, just if you think that masculinity is something that's important for contemporary men today. So if you want to kind of touch on any of that.
So I think it's a great question. I think this is the hard question because once we start doing definitions, you know, it gets very tricky. And so a couple of things I would say to contextualize what I want to say is that I don't consider myself a masculinist. I consider myself humanist. And so my interest in masculinity kind of secondary to my interest in humanity. So I'm interested in men doing well as men because that feels important for humanity. And so it's I get uncomfortable with a masculinist approach, you know, which seems to put maleness first rather than just put it alongside however we would want to define the feminine or femininity. But I do think that we can sort of look out and say, here's some things about masculinity. Now, the one thing I would actually add to that is that I call myself, and I'm sure there's probably a better academic word for this, but a tendencyist rather than an essentialist. So as a tendencyist, I think that males have tendencies that are probabilistic. They're more likely to be there. They're probably grounded or very likely grounded in neurobiology, you know, in hormonal effects and in sexual dimorphism, essentially, rather than being grounded in just cultural norms. But I do think there's tendencies, we can point to them, but there's a broad spectrum, and tendencies aren't completely immutable, whereas essences are immutable. So I don't believe in that form of masculinity. Mm-hmm. But I would say there are a couple of things that I think define masculine tendency. And one of them is a tendency toward what is called dominance behavior. So the tendency of men to seek positions of power and leadership in any given environment. Mm-hmm. And there's a controversial but incredibly lucid book on this, which is terribly titled, but is really an important piece, and it's by a fellow named Steven Goldberg. The title of the book is Why Men Rule, A Theory of Male Dominance. And the title is very provocative, but the piece is very straightforward. And what he argues from that is that there's probably a biological propensity of men to seek positions of dominance. He even argues that even in the modern cultures, even the one we have now, that I think women won a number of Senate seats, but they're up to 17. So it's 80-20. And if you look in the ranks of high-level business people, who's the most dominant, it's still very over-dominated by men. Now, we may be coming into a time where we're no longer comfortable with this. And I think we have a real existential choice around this. We can either say, okay, this is something that seems to be true, has been true throughout history, and we're either going to channel it in a way that serves humanity, or we're going to fight it, and we're going to argue with it, or we're just going to deny that it's the case. And I think the problem, particularly with this for women, is that when this tendency of men is not channeled well, it is very damaging to women, both in the sense that it gets channeled pathologically towards women, But then also women have the experience of men who are not in touch with this aspect of themselves and are very unhappy with the male partners that they have. And this is a partial point, but, you know, this is the point I take from people like David Data, who are sort of saying the male has to step into his purpose, step into his calling, these kinds of things. He's saying, get in touch with this tendency. And I think there's a partial truth there that I just look out at postmodern culture and I see that we are stuck in abstractions, we're stuck in arguments, and we're missing this, and then we're all dissatisfied because we're not channeling it properly. I think the other piece about what might define masculinity or the tendencies of masculinity are tendencies towards systemization, meaning wanting to understand non-living systems and to systematize things, and then a tendency towards wanting to abstract. So these are not better or worse tendencies, but when we're looking at things that are non-living systems and we're looking at things that are highly abstract, fields, professions, we tend to see a preponderance of men. So the computer industry would be a perfect thing. It's a totally non-living system. It requires an intense focus on one thing to the exclusion of often everything else, including relationships. It's not a better or worse. It's just we do find men and boys in these kinds of worlds and attracted these kinds of worlds. Historically, philosophy, although this has changed to a certain extent and there's a lot of great women philosophers, the preponderance, the dominance is towards to see men in these kind of highly abstract endeavors. But again, I'm thinking about the raising of boys and young men and to say, okay, if you have some of these tendencies, great, wonderful. This may be a gift of your masculinity, and how can we channel this? Now, the question naturally then arises, how do we handle women who have these tendencies or want to go in these fields? And I think at this point, I just see this as non-problematic. There's no reason. It's been shown, it's an empirical fact, there are women who exist at all levels in these fields, including the highest level. So I don't see that we have to correct something, but to live in the world in which these tendencies are not recognized as probabilistically true is an issue. So I think the dominance tendency, the abstraction, the systematizing tendency, and there's research to support all of this in various domains, are things that we can say these are parts of masculinity. Now, a couple more things about this. So what about male sensitivity? So these all sound like non-relational things. I don't see any of these versions of masculinity in conflict with male sensitivity or men having emotions, because I think it's integral to the species that men feel a sense of bond to their bonding partner, you know, if they're married or partnered, and that they feel a sense of bond to their children. And even when we look at men who occupy the most quote-unquote masculine roles, if you start to talk to them, you hear this bonding and relationality. So like the most masculine role that pops off the top of my head is a mixed martial arts fighter. So this is somebody who goes in and essentially is like, whose job is to fight another opponent. This is the most archetypal masculine role of fighter, warrior, defender. Then once you interview them after the fight, they almost never say, well, I'm just so thankful that I'm a male and I did it for myself. They start thanking their teammates. They start thanking their coaches. They start dedicating it to their family. And this is an enormously missed part of masculinity that men do almost whatever they're going to do with other people in mind, those closest to them, be that women or children or other men. The only group that doesn't do that are sociopathic men who have no connection to anybody but themselves. Unfortunately, though, sociopathic visions of maleness are what we see in the culture. So that is a huge problem because they get a lot of the attention, and I think it's a there are arguments being made now that the role of sociopaths in the culture really is huge because they create such problems, even though they're 1 to 2% of the population at most. So I do think having a healthy vision of masculinity, thinking in terms of tendencies and probabilities, is important, but it doesn't mean that, therefore, male sensitivity or men don't have emotions or all of these other things are true. They may carry them somewhat differently, but we don't have to have an inhumane vision of maleness, and it's not my experience.
There's a couple questions that came up when you were talking that I'd love to ask you. So I was thinking about, we can bring it, kind of tie it back with this End of Men article, which was actually an article that came out in The Atlantic magazine, I think a couple of years ago, and then it was turned into a book. And it's been actually quite heavily criticized for some of the statistics. But some of this woman's arguments were around, you know, especially when you're talking about dominance and these tendencies, you know, one of Hannah Rosen's arguments was that the world is moving increasingly away from more manufacture-based jobs. You know, the kind of argument that the reason men have been dominant is because they're physically stronger. Throughout history, they've been able to, you know, overpower the other sex and then have had the opportunity to, you know, in the kind of context we've been in, having strength has been really prioritized. So there's been some arguments that that makes sense of why men would take more positions of leadership or ruling. But that her argument is basically the jobs of the future are becoming increasingly communication-based, you know, needing really high levels of emotional intelligence, more soft social skills. And so one of the arguments she was making in the article is that women are more fit for this domain. So the shift of what is seen as power is changing. Now, this is interesting. You know, it's obviously complex. There's a lot that we could go into there, but it brings up the question of if this essential aspect of power dominance is a tendency in men, you know, how that gets channeled in the kind of world we're living in now, particularly where strong, powerful, aggressive male may be seen in a particular light that's not very positive anymore. And so how we work with that. And then is this accurate? Like, do women really have the skills that are going to be more useful in the future and men, you know, become increasingly irrelevant, which is kind of her argument.
Sure. So I think there's a complex answer to this question. So I think that there is definitely a truth that the world is shifting and that the skills required in our current setting are either more gender neutral or there is a leaning towards things where women may be stronger on average. And so, but I would just point out the distinction between saying a book called The Future is Increasingly Favoring Women or The Future is Balancing Gender Equality and The End of Men. So just sort of to meditate on the distinction between an argument about a cultural shift versus the title, which is essentially pointing or suggesting we would, you know, end men. I mean, it's such an intellectual failure, almost inexcusable to go from one argument to that title. And for the culture to pick that up, I think, is problematic. Now, in terms of the shifting roles, I do think that this is an issue, that we've shifted from both an agrarian to then an industrial and now a more service-based economy and information-based. Now, there are some things in our current economy that may favor males in terms of the information-based kind of aspects of it or the intense systemization aspects of it. But I do think that there are a lot of roles that are just changing and becoming more, they lean in the tendency that women have. And I think that that is a good thing. I don't see any reason to deny that. However, what I would suggest, and here we can sharpen our vision of what dominance means. Dominance is not always about dominating in the sense of being powerful or strong. It means more like that in a given situation, men will attempt to figure out how to gain power, and they are very interested in this. Mm-hmm. So if the jobs of the future require more emotional intelligence, and certain kinds of skill sets that men will attempt to fill those roles and to reconfigure themselves in order to fill those roles. Now, does that mean that we're going to see any vision of society like we've seen in the past where it's really almost exclusively male dominance with some female exceptions. Now I think the scales are going to balance, but men are going to be there because they have this drive to gain power in a certain way. So whatever the new, I guess what I would say is, I would put it a little flippantly, whatever the new game is, men are going to figure out how to play it. And we either honor that and teach them how to play it in a way that is fair and in a way that is honorable and in a way that serves their interests but also serves the society as a whole, or we are going to be blinders to it, and then we don't socialize them into fairness or honor, and then we end up with this kind of sort of loose cannon version of maleness.
Or a really feminized, you know, like I was thinking the other side, where men are increasingly encouraged to be more like women.
Yes. You get the criticism that, like, you're not feminine enough, or you're too masculine, or whatever, it's I don't feel it. And so you're constantly being asked to manifest a certain quality that you can't manifest. You can be a soft masculine energy, but I don't really believe the idea that women can be masculine or that men can be feminine. I really believe more in the idea that women have a strong side and a soft side. Men have a strong side and a soft side, more or less. And you can have more or less of both of those, but you can't embody the other gender. I think it's very presumptuous and kind of like an abstract idea. But I do think that what we're asking is, we are asking men to be so much of their soft side, and we're so uncomfortable with what I would call strong masculinity because we associate it with its pathological dimension, that we are pushing it down. So we've lost that strong, we've lost a healthy, strong masculinity that we're not just ready to criticize, I would say.
Right. Well, I think this is big around, I mean, it's obviously so complex, but I think, you know, where the words masculine and feminine can be useful orientation, kind of like guideposts for understanding certain things, I think as concepts, they become increasingly loose in how people use them, and a lot of people don't really know what they mean when they're saying them or have a certain sense of it in their mind, but it could be relayed with all kinds of cultural, you know, assumptions or just all kinds of things that people aren't aware of what they're speaking about when they use the terms. And I think in its more unhealthy, extreme form is when it even becomes a kind of ideology. So,
yeah.
I mean, this, I think this ties into our next question. Well, the next question I wanted to ask you about was around this discourse that has really emerged in the spiritual transformational self-help world. And I really say that I really understand the impulse behind it. I understand a lot of the purposes for why it has arisen. And I think there's some partial truths to it that are important. And it's not to deny any of that. But I think there's been a really huge emphasis on this kind of emerging return of the feminine in culture.
Mm, yeah.
And the sense that women are really poised at the forefront of this kind of coming spiritual or cultural transformation. And I mean, this particular discourse really started in the 60s with the feminist goddess movements and has become increasingly prevalent in the spiritual world, I would say, over the last decade. And the Dalai Lama even quoted, Western women will save the world, and that the qualities of women, you know, are the ones that are really needed in the culture. So, I mean, again, I could defend a particular aspect of this that I think I understand where this impulse is coming from, an attempt to kind of rebalance certain energies and all this. And obviously, as we've been talking about, women certainly being in a certain position where there is a shift in emphasis around what is valued as certain kind of skills or values that are being given more emphasis. But what this means as, you know, I mean, I think I'm always fascinated at how anything can become a kind of ism or ideology.
Yes.
You know? And
yeah.
And that's more where my interest is like, what's the impact of that going to be on men, on women too? And are we setting ourselves up for something, you know, that we're not quite aware of yet? So I'm really curious about that, because I've actually kind of even thought that at some point there may be even a backlash on this particular issue from men if this emphasis on the feminine becomes increasingly kind of intense. So I'm just curious if you had any thoughts on that or
sure.
What your sense of it was.
Well, this is a recent kind of, I wouldn't call it a revelation, but it's the recent sort of thought I had that, so what is it about that we, you know, have both sexes feel, you know, sort of underserved, and increasingly men are beginning to talk about this, and women have been talking about this for a long time. And I think that what seems true to me is that in our culture, our modern culture, with all of its mixtures of other sort of cultures and ideals, neither sex gets appreciated. So we don't appreciate the feminine. We don't really appreciate the masculine. Nobody is actually winning at all. And so when I hear the call that we need to bring in the feminine, what I hear is we need to honor women in their full humanity. And whether we have a clear idea of that or not, we want that to happen. There's some intuition that we have that we are not honoring women or honoring women's contributions or allowing women to express their full humanity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that goes the same for men. It's just not happening. We're not there yet. And that may not be a failure of the past. It may be sort of an evolution to the future. But I do think if we pick a side, like seems to be happening, and says what is going to save us is the return to the feminine, or that only the sort of wholeness of women is going to save us, we are in probably deep trouble. Because I think we do need more women in positions of power. We need better gender balance. And my experience has always been in groups that are gender balanced, they're more effective. They're actually more effective groups, and groups that are gender unbalanced tend to be less effective. So that's what I take out of it. But I do think this idea that, like, somehow being a woman in and of itself, apart from qualities you develop, or somehow your womanhood just all by itself without developing a certain kind of womanhood is going to save, you know, which is, I think, is the way that people seem to be translating it. Like, there's all this discussion about I'm going to be the goddess in me, and just flip that around. If, you know, men started walking around and saying the God in me, and saying it with this kind of, like, it's just self-justified. I think that kind of that's a naive self-affirmation. And what it comes from, I think, is, you know, that most people in the culture are at conventional levels of development. They have unmet needs around self-esteem. They have unhealed wounds. And so given the opportunity to sort of feel good about themselves without having to work at it that much, they'll take it. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of the discourse we hear around gender is informed by a kind of narcissism in oneself. And what's different now is that we're now open enough as a society where women can enjoy the fruits of narcissism in the way that I think men have enjoyed in the past.
Right.
And so I think we're going to recapitulate where definitely in the past, the culture was biased towards men, and then we got to see that somehow just being a man in and of itself doesn't entitle you to anything and doesn't mean you're going to be good at something. As women continually rise to positions of power, we're going to see the same thing, that women, just because they're women, are going to not succeed or be some kind of panacea for the culture. It's going to come back to this very interesting concept of it's about the quality of your person. Now, you may be a woman person, you may be a man person, you may identify or have traits that are strong in a tendency direction, but it's still about the quality of who you are, and that's thinking ahead. And I think if the Dalai Lama says it, that's wonderful, and the Dalai Lama is an enlightened being, but enlightened beings say things that are incorrect all the time, particularly when they're outside of their domain of expertise. So the Dalai Lama is an able, you know, diplomat, but I don't know that his expertise isn't in the future of building societies. Maybe he has some psychic intuition that this is the case, but when I hear that, I think, oh, this is not going to help. What I would say is we need women to be at their best. We need men to be at their best. We need to honor the wholeness of everybody, and we need to allow a freedom for people to move into positions of power and influence where we have the best people, male or female, and if there's something about that role that is better suited to a male or a woman, and this isn't often the case, that's fine, but we need a more universal message of wholeness for both sexes. Because if women just ascend and take over, I think we'll see a lot of the same problems or different problems recapitulated, and we're going to also see a lot of dissatisfied women, frankly, and a lot of angry, underperforming men. Like if we were to carry that thought experiment out, you know, the planet is in several positions of crisis. We need everybody, and we need to encourage and help everybody.
And that's kind of seems like the paradox I've been feeling too. Like, I really like what you said. It really resonated for me. And something around, like, we both need to really honor the uniqueness of people as they are, you know, in their femaleness and their maleness or whatever, however they express that, and at the same time not make it so sacred that it becomes so important. And I think that's where the edge always turns, you know, for me is, like, how we actually hold that paradox, that it's sacred and it's not.
Yeah. It is this paradox, and I think there's this danger in, you know, in spiritual circles of overlaying. I have never related to that idea that somehow, like, spirit is really, like, masculine or feminine in a literal sense, the concretization of that idea. I get it as a metaphor. It's interesting as a symbol. I don't know, maybe on some high level of enlightenment that gets revealed to you and somebody pulls the curtain. But I do think, yeah, if we are all sacred as people and individual beings and our male and femaleness or transgenderedness or whatever is all important and sacred, and yet it's not so much. You shouldn't take it for granted. I mean, it's that paradox of, like, you're good as just as you are and yet earn something. Be a better person. Work today to contribute to the world and with your own unique gifts. And, you know that your contribution is hugely important and may have divine significance, and at the same time, you're a drop in a bucket and it's a small matter, whatever it is that you do. And holding that paradox, I think, is tricky, but I just think you have to see yourself. If you can see to the bottom of yourself, you'll see the paradox of yourself. I think it was Nisargadatta, and I'm mixing up my sages here, who said something like, my heart tells me I'm everything, my head tells me I'm nothing, and between these two poles, my life moves. I apologize if I botched the quote, but I think that there's something to that. When you see into yourself deeply enough, you see the brilliance and you see the shining, and then you also see the in some way, just the ephemeral insignificance of yourself. And then what moves you from that space is maybe not you, or maybe not something you can take a ton of credit for. Mm-hmm. And there may be male and female or masculine and feminine versions of that, but we need more people who can see that. How are we going to produce a society with more people who can hold that paradox and don't need to tie too tightly to an ism? Yeah. By raising them as healthy as we can. Mm-hmm. And that process, building off natural, healthy developmental course, leads people, I think, to this deeper space. And, of course, we need more people in that deeper space. But we can't forget how one gets there, which is sometimes a more mundane process. And a lot of my concern for men is that we've chopped out the middle of the ladder, more or less. My concerns for women are the same, although I feel less qualified to say what exactly we're chopping out.
Yeah,
but
I was going to say I feel the same way with women in postmodern culture. Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the part where, so from your perspective, what do you think women, if we're going to use the latter metaphor, get chopped out? What don't they get?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really complex, and I want to, you know, I'll be careful about, I mean, I definitely research these topics, and I can speak from my own experience. I don't want to speak for all women, but I definitely would say from what I've seen in engaging with younger women and teen girls, I think similar to what you were saying, although I don't know if I would frame it as we need more femininity grounding, it's something around a sense of role and place. So because women's roles have been exploded to such a degree that we can, like, there's so much opportunity and choice, that there's actually a kind of stuckness that ends up happening. So, like, there's so many choices, and I don't really know which choice is better, that there becomes, for a lot of young women, like a sort of endless searching or just choosing to the more superficial aspects of experience. And there's not a lot of, like, really strong role models for, I think, you know, a really dignified womanhood, a really dignified sexuality, a really dignified sense of self. I think there's a lot of lack of dignity in women that are represented in popular culture. And so in a way that like, I think that kind of dignity and sense of role, a sense of place.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I often give the example, and I think I heard it from Elizabeth Diebold once, that women who, you know, you meet in traditional cultures, even if they are in more patriarchal settings, tend to have a certain sense of dignity that you don't find in postmodern women as easily.
Yeah.
There's a sense of just like they know their role, they know their place. So I think, you know, it's similar to what you were saying. We have different challenges. I think there's actually more options open to women, but I don't know if that actually makes us better off sometimes.
I think I totally understand what you're saying, and I really agree. And I think we need to come to a sense of neo-traditionalism, a sense that we have roles and places that give us dignity, and yet we have some of the very hard-won flexibility that, you know, the last 50 years in particular has introduced to us, although it might be a longer historical process even than that if you really look at it. But how we come to that place where we can really give people, or people have a sense of place and role and dignity and yet also freedom, that to me feels like the holy grail.
And responsibility too, right, that comes out of
Yes. And I think the idea for me of role is tied up in responsibility.
Yeah.
You have a role gives you that. But yes, freedom and responsibility, I think, is a great way to put it. Articulating what this new vision would be that has a better balance of role and freedom, responsibility, and all that for men and women, I just think it needs to happen. And it feels like, to a certain extent, you know, I'm a little older than you, but we are of the same generation, and it feels to me like it falls to our generation to try to do this, because I think we're the first generation after the experiment of the 60s that can see, like, we're the first group that has the opportunity to wrestle with all the pieces. Like, I don't think by the time you and I fall off the earth that it'll be done, but I'm hopeful that we, as a generation, are beginning the process or picking up the ball and taking it forward.
Cool. I really appreciated your insight, and I feel a lot of resonance just with what you're saying, so I appreciate having the complexity that we've pulled out in the dialogue around the issues too, because I think it's really important. So
great. It was totally my pleasure. I really enjoyed the dialogue, and I really enjoyed just the opportunity to speak about these things.
Benzai Guru Pema Siddhi.